Hello, everybody in podcast land. On this Friday morning, this is Trevin McGee from the Scene Stealers podcast, and I'm here. In addition to my usual cohorts, we've got a couple of special guests today. So I'm going to introduce them first because they're more important. We've got Tony Laddish, the director of Two Sisters, a short that just won at the Kansas City Film Festival. And also he's from Mile Deep Films. And then we've got Mr. Alan Rapp, who I guest on the Dad's Big Plan podcast with from time to time. So hello, gentlemen.
How's it going?
Hello.
All right. And then, of course, I've got Eric Moline and Trey Hawk. We're also here. So
nobody wants to hear from them.
No. They don't have anything to say.
Yeah, except for the fact that we wanted to congratulate Tony. Two Sisters is an amazing short film, and Trevin and Trey and I spent the weekend at the Kansas City Film Festival, and you can find all that coverage on Scene Stealers right now. But in addition to Tony being here, we also have award-winning screenwriter Trey Hawk.
It's true.
Who actually wrote the movie, so or wrote the film. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's difficult work being so incredible.
So you also just got back from Chicago, right?
Yeah, we were in Kansas. We played here on the Wednesday the 11th. And then I got on a plane and went to Chicago for the SimFest, which is the Chicago International Movies and Music Festival. And it was seriously one of the coolest festivals I've ever been to in my entire life because it's music and performances and movies about music. And that's all it is.
Oh,
and
cool.
It was, yeah, and I had a bunch of conversations with like the festival directors and those guys and just the people that put it on. And I was like, man, it's like when you're in high school and you feel really weird because you don't relate to anybody. And then you find like two or three kids that love the same right. band as you. And you're like, you like the English Beat. I like the English Beat. And, you know, all of a sudden, you're like, you're not alone. Like, that's the way I felt at this film festival. Because I'm not terribly great in situations where I don't know anyone at all. But when you feel like you're around your people, right. it's a lot easier to kind of just like let loose and
yeah.
whatever. So it was cool. So we were there and we played on Saturday there and it was amazing. And I had our actors there, Mark Smelter, Casey Roush was there, as well as Richard Fisher, who plays the husband, and producer Mikal Shapiro. And so the night before we played on Saturday outside the Logan Theater in Chicago, which is cool. It's like Screenland kind of renovated
mm-hmm.
with a bar and awesome theater. Mark and Casey pulled out their instruments, and Mark was singing with his banjo on the street and drew this huge crowd. And I'm passing out postcards. Come on down. Come see the short tomorrow and, like, see that guy on the postcard. That's that dude. And like, we had a bunch of people that came to the screening, and we did a Q&A, and I brought all the actors down to do a Q&A. And it was amazing. It was great. It was a really cool experience. And the SimFest seemed to love us, and they were stoked that we were there and so excited about it. And, you know, the response I got was kind of like, hey, man, just keep making movies and send them to us. So
cool.
You should do that. Then.
One of the things I liked about it was that a lot of times when you see music portrayed in movies, it's often by a director or somebody that put together the movie who doesn't understand music, doesn't know how it's performed right. or, you know, how to properly stage it
right.
in a movie. And this was really nice because it was an integral part. It was the inspiration, right?
It was the inspiration. And, the thing is, like, every single one of the actors are musicians. And it was important to me that they were musicians as much or more than they were actors.
Right.
Casey's not an actress, really. Mark is not really an actor. I mean, Aaron McGrain obviously is, and Richard is. And they're fantastic. And but Casey and Mark delivered two unbelievable performances. And part of the reason that I think that the movie comes off the way it does is because in all of the work that we did before we shot and all the work that we did on set in terms of myself as a director, I directed them like I was directing a musical arrangement. Everything was in regard to tempo and harmony and like I would talk about emotions in regard to harmony and how this is how you're supposed to resonate with this person. And I was speaking in a language that musicians
Everybody.
Would understand.
Yeah, totally.
And it's all about tempo and timing and all these things. And man, they just, everybody got it. Everybody was on the same page. And it was amazing. It was great. It was one of the best experiences I've ever had.
So how do people see this movie that are listening to the podcast? What's the next step?
We'll probably do another few screenings here at some point. Somebody just contacted me today. I think they're trying to do a screening in Lawrence, Tall Grass, something or other.
Oh, yeah.
Free State.
So that lineup just got announced today.
I'll email that guy back.
And it's a music and
film festival. Yeah, it's right up your alley. Definitely get in on that.
So that looks cool. And then I want to do a screening where I basically buy the armor for a night and put on, do a musical performance by the actors and maybe show a couple of other shorts and kind of curate the night and then do Two Sisters and give people a chance to see the film kind of in a setting that I create. We had a Phil Peterson's one of my best buddies and he's an incredible still photographer and he kind of works on all of my sets doing still photography. And he took some unbelievable behind the scenes photographs that are art in and of themselves and not just that, but like there's a lot of photographs that he did that were scenes. Like he would not, like you're not seeing the camera or any of the crew, you're just seeing the actors in there, you know, it's as though he was taking still photo shoot of our film shoot. And so I want to do kind of a gallery showing of his photography there at that screening. I want to have the instrument that Mark or the Traveling Minstrel created. It's as a set, you know, as a sculptural piece, and there's some artwork involved in the film and some, you know, some drawings and stuff that we did. Just some of the ephemera involved in the film. I want to, you know, kind of just curate the space and just have it be kind of an immersive thing. So
that's awesome. So
that was really fucking pretentious, wasn't it?
No, hey. Well, you did mention Terrence Malick when we were talking earlier.
I did.
So,
yeah.
I think it's right up that alley, right?
Yeah.
Which
confusing and fucking weird.
Awesome. Yeah. So cool. So congratulations to you guys. And I hope everybody else gets to see it in the future.
Awesome.
Really just congratulations to Tony. I know Trey well enough.
Yeah, you know, Trey's riding my coattails.
Yeah.
Tony took my crappy words and made them beautiful.
There you go.
That's the alchemy of filmmaking, you know? It's like I'm constantly cleaning up Trey's messes.
Yes. So moving on, we're going to there's an event going on today, actually, tonight at the Screenland Theater, the Crossroads, called An Evening of 8-Bit featuring Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Trevin, you want to fill everybody in on that?
I do. It's the day. You've got to go. It's tonight. Starts at 7 o'clock. The screening's at 9 o'clock. It's $10. We're in partnership with Lost in Reviews. It's largely their idea, and they deserve a ton of credit for coming up with it and putting it together. And it's just the entire night is just that. It's a celebration of that whole 8-bit kind of indie geek culture that's right at the forefront of the Scott Pilgrim movie and the comics. We're going to have a Sex Bob-omb cover band. We're going to have retro arcade games and tournaments. Tall Grass's 8-bit beer is going to be
8-bit pale ale,
yeah. Which just got mentioned in Esquire.
It did.
So it's a really good pale ale, really good beer. We're glad to have them as a partner. All that's going to be there, and I'm not allowed to say how exactly, but Edgar Wright is involved, too.
He's already tweeted about it,
yeah,
which is awesome.
Endorsed by Edgar Wright.
Yeah.
Edgar Wright is allowing us to show this film without paying him, like you normally would if you were to hold a screening of someone's film.
So, yeah, and you know, it's just going to be a fun, welcoming night, you know, all ages, I guess. I mean, they're serving beer, but you don't have to be 21
theater
to get in.
Yeah.
And cosplay is encouraged. So I'm really looking forward to Eric's drummer costume, his Kim costume.
Well,
that's going to be good.
All I can say is when we did our...
Trey's going as Scott Pilgrim. I'm going to go as Steven Stills. And
I just have to take off my glasses.
Pretty much, yeah.
You guys won't have to do anything, you skinny bastards.
But really, Alan needs more photos of cosplay so that he can put them up. When is your cosplay day? Cosplay Wednesdays or whatever?
There's no specific day.
Oh, well, every day is cosplay day. Okay, that's right. Alan needs more cosplay, so please show up and so he can take your photo.
I saw two amazing Scott Pilgrim Halloween costumes when we did our show at the Bottleneck last year.
Yeah.
And I know that both of those are going to be there. So
good.
The bar will be set pretty high.
Yeah. I saw a really good Lucas Lee.
Yeah.
A year ago, I saw a really good Lucas Lee. That's
nice. Yeah.
Was it just me walking down the street?
It was just Trey. I realized it wasn't Halloween. It was just Trey. I get Trey and Brandon Routh mixed up all the time.
We're both very handsome.
Constantly.
Vegan power? Yeah. Are you a vegan, Trey?
Well, yes, actually.
Yeah. that explains it.
You guys fit so many of those stereotypes. It's awesome.
What, you do too.
No, I'm a little fat pants. I'm not into those
little
video games.
Fat pants.
So I like the movie though.
That is true. Eric has never been a shirtless drummer.
Little fat
that's
pants.
Not true. Actually.
That sounds like
when
a shittier version.
Drummer?
Truck stop love days.
Oh, that's right.
Back when
I that.
I could take my shirt off.
Shorts, no
yeah.
shoes, no shirt.
Yeah, yeah.
Tons of service.
Yeah, there was a lot of service. Yeah.
Little fat pants sounds like a shitty spinoff of Little Nemo. Like Little Nemo's just
Little Nemo's
idiot
porn,
cousin.
Short little fat pants.
Idiot cousin. Short little fat pants.
Moving on. Let's not dwell.
Nemo will get us there.
Okay. There you go.
It will. Yeah. That was kind of what I was going for. Anyway, okay. we've talked 10 minutes about all kinds of
nice
important
fucking
stuff.
Segue.
Isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Silky smooth.
This is my first podcast.
Yeah.
I'm noticing I'm like kind of taking in the metadata. And
it's a professional outfit here, if you couldn't tell. So,
we're going to move on to Cabin in the Woods. Mm-hmm. And here's what we're going to do. I'm just going to lay this out, guys, and I'm changing the plans already. All right? This is the new Joss Whedon movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually the
written.
New
Drew
Goddard
Drew Goddard directed
movie.
It. Yep. Yeah.
And co-wrote it. Don't forget that.
Correct. Thank you for that. But this movie, if you know anything about it, it's being marketed as a movie kind of like The Crying Game or whatever, where you're not supposed to reveal its secrets. I will say this. This is not a twist movie. This is a movie where
there's a
gradual amount of information is given to you over a certain amount of time, and then it has a huge payoff, in my opinion. But
is that The Crying Game?
Yeah.
A huge payoff?
Yeah. So... So we're going to talk about the film for about 5 minutes, not 10. We're going to talk about it for about 5 minutes without revealing any spoilers. And then, especially since this film's already been out for a week, we are going to delve into its
we're
going to
make a spoiler announcement, and then we're going to go for it.
And then we're
going
to go for it. So if you haven't seen Cabin
in the Woods,
we're
going to get all up in that film's guts.
We are. Yep. We are. So, Trey, do you want to start us out?
Sure. Very simple plot synopsis because I can't reveal too much.
No.
But a group of college students decide to...
30-year-old Hollywood actors playing college students.
True. 30-year... Yeah, yeah, yeah. A group of college students are going to head off into the woods for a little getaway, a little vacation, just to kind of blow off some steam, get away from studies. We know that one of them has had, you know, maybe a troubled relationship, sort of a tryst with a professor, and wants to kind of get out of town.
And one of them might be a Norse god.
One of them may be a Norse god,
yeah.
You know, in his other job. But they, you know, they go out and things quickly start looking not what they seem.
I think you should be fair and just go ahead and mention that the very first scene in the film is not the kids in the cabin, but rather two men in a pale, fluorescent, lit office building.
That's true.
And we don't really know who they are or what they're doing, but I don't think revealing that they exist is
sure.
a spoiler.
Well, based on the commercials kind of giving away the movie's best surprise. Like, the current television ad campaign is kind of spoiled it a little bit. I don't want to go into it too far, but I don't think it's too bad to say that there are bigger things at play. Basically, they're going to go into the woods and it takes on some regular horror movie type tropes, but then it turns out that there's kind of a reason or a justification for that, and the movie sort of deals with that next.
That was 5 minutes, right?
Exactly. 5 minutes.
Well, but we can say little without giving away the full plot. I mean, even in it, if the movie tells you something in the first 10 minutes, it's not really a spoiler to talk about that. And basically, you know, the people in this laboratory or factory, whatever this place is, are controlling what's going to happen to the kids.
Yeah.
And that gives the movie a nice twist, especially when you learn how many different things they can control. That's where the film's, I think, kind of genius comes in.
You know what? Coming off of the Hunger Games, I mean, it was really interesting to see somebody do something that was way more adventurous and had way more of a point Like, it just seems like the Hunger Games was like this very, I don't know, like I didn't think they utilized that aspect of the story very well in the Hunger Games. Of course, that's, you know, what this whole thing is about. So, but.
Well, you know, I walked into both of these movies having no idea. Like, I didn't even know Hunger Games was a book because, you know, I'm a 40-year-old man, right? And you know, walking into that movie, I had zero clue what was going on. And if I had known it was a book and I had known, you know, some of the tropes of the book, some of the plot holes wouldn't have felt so huge.
Right.
But the point, that's, you know, you shouldn't make a movie that has giant plot holes in it. Anyway, right. But that's, you know.
That was our big criticism.
Let's just, yeah, let's we can not talk about Hunger Games. But the thing, I had seen, you know, the theatrical trailer for Cabin in the Woods, and that's all I knew. I had no idea anything else about it. And I'm not a horror fan.
Right.
I'm just, in general, I don't like, actually, I like scary movies, like The Others, and I mean, like, movies that are really good and scary.
I will agree with you on that. I like suspense or thrillers, yes. But I'm not a horror, gore.
Well, and I don't like torture porn, Saw, any of that fucking Human Centipede bullshit. Like, I don't,
totally.
This is the fucking internet, man.
Yeah. No one gives a shit.
I can't stand that shit. I don't like it at all. Like, I'm not into it. And, Hitchcock said it best, that it's easy to startle people and it's hard to keep them in suspense. And that's, you know what I mean? That's what I like. So I don't mind having the piss scared out of me as long as it's genuinely something that's
frightening. But what's interesting about this film is it's not really gory, although there's blood. It's a horror movie.
I mean,
it's not focused on the gore.
Movie. Okay, when they round the hallway,
but they
at
don't,
the
it's,
end,
it doesn't
and
cross
like,
the threshold. Can we make?
All right, hang on. We haven't really said anything about it yet. We kind of need to get
before
to where
we
what man like
first.
Five horny co-eds go into the woods. They go to the cabin. They're gonna party down. One kid wants to smoke a bunch of dope. They got a keg.
Nope.
And then shit goes wrong.
Okay, here's
that's the end of the 5 minutes, right?
Yeah. So what I wanted to say was, and I'm going to issue the spoiler alert right here because I think that my question you guys will not be able to answer without spoiling it. So official spoiler alert:
the canopy
if you listen
is
past
the blast
this,
doors are down.
Yes,
the
you're fucked.
Alert, this is only for people who've seen the movie.
Turn off
you're one of
the
those people who want to know everything that you're going to see before you go in the movie, which means that you watch trailers a lot. Okay,
we've hit the purge button.
My question to you guys:
unplug your connection.
My question to you guys is this, and this is one of the questions that a lot of people on the internet, the people who are detractors of the film, are talking about. And that is, you said that you enjoy being so scared and being held in suspense.
So scared?
Yeah.
So scared.
What did I say?
You said,
I was so scared, I stuttered.
I was so scared.
Well, it's a combination of being suspended.
Holy
being
Eric,
scared.
I'm so scared.
This
is my first day.
Yeah.
So I'm never being asked back.
So if that's the case, is this movie too... Does it have too much ironic detachment, and is it too meta to actually hold you in suspense, and is that something negative to say about the film?
Okay, so, spoilers, look, here's the deal. This movie, first of all, I really enjoyed it. I had a fucking blast. It was one of the funnest movies I've seen in a long time. I totally like it. I would recommend it to anyone. The movie was fucking ruined for me in the first 2 seconds. So the very beginning of the film... When the opening credits, and it's this weird kind of bloody motion graphic thing with all these fucking Egyptian hieroglyphics and all this shit, that I nudged Trey, and I'm like, they just fucked up. They fucked up right there. They just ruined it. Because I knew exactly what was going to happen at the end of the movie. And remember, I don't know jack shit about what this movie's about.
Yeah.
I knew it was going to be some sort of fucking human sacrifice thing. I knew it was going to have something to do with some sort of weird fucking secret society bullshit. And I didn't know
but does that ruin the entire movie? I mean,
look, if you're going to make a movie like The Sixth Sense where you're not supposed to fucking know that Bruce Willis... Oh, spoiler alert if you've never seen The Sixth Sense. You're not supposed to know that Bruce Willis is a fucking ghost, then
Wait. Bruce Willis was a ghost?
Yeah, no, sorry. Yeah. Yeah, Santa Claus doesn't exist either. And then, but yeah, then in that regard, on that level,
of making a movie that you're not supposed, like, don't nobody fuck it up for everybody else in America.
But I do think they kind of give that away pretty early on. I mean, not all at once, but they give it to you in chunks.
I knew the hand of God was coming out of the fucking ground from after the second second.
I don't know. There's a couple of things to consider there. I mean, does knowing that ruin the entire movie?
No, because clearly I enjoyed it.
Right. Well, you just said they fucked it up and ruined it.
They fucked up the surprise.
Tony, so, I'm going to disagree.
That doesn't mean that they fucked up the ride.
I'm going to disagree with you on this only because as soon as I saw that too, I thought, we're all film watchers.
Right.
I'm going to have to remember this later. And as soon as they started, revealing it, that's when I got that what was happening. And especially once we started to see the blood go down. I mean, it was pretty obvious.
So let me just say this.
But that's foreshadowing. It didn't really.
And also, it made me start thinking in that direction.
Fuck you. Fuck you. We've known each other for 15 years. Fuck you. You want to talk about foreshadowing? American Psycho. That's foreshadowing. Those are opening credits. It's a drip of blood. White screen. Another drop of blood. Another drop of blood, all punctuated with this fucking orchestral music, and then a fucking stream of blood, and then it's fucking drawing shit in this white, and you're like, fuck, it's called American Psycho, and there's blood everywhere. And then they fucking cut to a shot, and they're drizzling raspberry sauce on some sort of fucking dessert.
Yeah.
That was fucking art, and that was fucking this.
I don't
like
think
the
that's,
beginning.
So you like
I don't
the
think
opening
that's
credits
foreshadowing.
Of
I think that's metaphor.
No, I see what you're saying.
When I was in school,
I wrote a fucking 20-page paper on the opening 3 minutes of American Psycho, because of that. Because I think it's brilliant storytelling. Because the name's American Psycho.
It's American Psycho, and there's blood everywhere, and then it's not blood. But in this, to me, was just too obvious. It was like they could have done the opening credits, and it could have just said whatever, and it could have been white on black, and I would have been so much more stoked at the end.
I will argue that opening the credits with the scenes of sacrifice, which were obviously ancient from wherever they were, and then going right to two guys in office in office attire in this fluorescently lit building was actually a brilliant stroke, because you think that you're getting one thing and then they deliver you another thing, and then they deliver you another thing, which is the kids in the cabin. And at this point, you're trying to figure everything out. I don't think everybody is going to come up with the entire movie like you did.
Tony and I did chuckle about it.
Sat right next to him while they chuckled.
We did chuckle about it because he nudged me and was like, they just ruined this. And I just started laughing. I just thought it was hilarious because I had just noticed the same thing. Now, do I think that ruined the movie?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No. That didn't ruin the movie.
That's an interesting thing. I'm glad you brought it up. But did this movie hold you in suspense, or was the meta-ness of it, did it make you too detached from everything?
I'm going to let other people talk for a little while because...
Well, I'd go back to what I was saying before is what I was surprised about this movie is everything it's not, and it still works. I don't think it is real suspenseful. I don't think it's not torture porn. It's all these things that you expect a horror movie to be, and it's not any of them, but it still works really well.
It's a patchwork, but to what you're saying, it is. To what you're saying, it's like, you know, it's like the cool kids in GQ that wear, you know, like striped ties with plaid shirts. You know what I mean? Like they're mixing, you know, they're mixing their metaphors really early, like immediately in this movie. And that's great. You know, like I really like that about it. But, you know, your point, Alan, was that it wasn't super gory. But the thing about it is that it was kind of gory.
It is really gory, but it doesn't revel in the gore.
The gore plays an integral part of the storyline. Yeah. It's not like, oh, my God, that guy's got a bear trap on a fucking chain and that's going to get gnarly. It does, but it's what happens after the bear trap. It's what happens after somebody's dead. It's what happens as a result of the gore that is the point. You know, that's a huge, move in the movie.
And they also use it to comedic effect, too. That's the other thing. This movie is a lot funnier than the current advertising campaign makes it look like.
And there's a reason for that, too,
yeah.
right? Because clearly, if you market something as a horror comedy, it does not sell.
It doesn't do well. And here's the thing. I think we all enjoyed this movie. I think that's abundantly clear. But with this, I think if you're a fan or if you're familiar with the genre, you're gonna get the most enjoyment out of it if you're a fan, because you're going to be able to pick up on the parody. You don't even have to be a fan of horror, just a fan of movies.
And that's something Whedon spoke to is that the reaction he's getting positive reaction from people who say they're not fans of horror
right.
movies. Horror movies.
Yeah, I do think you have to be at least familiar with some of the tropes that are used
to get
in
the
horror
most
films.
Enjoyment out
yeah.
of it. You
but
do.
I think people who don't like horror films are probably going to have most of those things, you know, sort of tragically
right.
burned into their mind.
Right. Because
so
the whole
go,
premise.
Oh yeah, I remembered that. That terrified me when I was three.
Right.
Well, Spinal Tap's funny whether or not you know that the beginning of Stonehenge is making fun of a Thin Lizzy song.
Right. Yeah. See. The thing about it that makes it so effective is just it takes all the sort of horror movie tropes and rationalizes them, and then makes them happen in such a funny, intentional way. And then, but then there's a bigger reason or a bigger meaning to why they do it, because it's part of this big sacrifice. There's just like two or three levels working here, and if you're a big fan of movies in general, or if you can recognize those kind of 80s horror movie tropes, you'll get the most enjoyment because you'll be able to see all three layers. But even, I mean, we were in a theater with people that I don't think necessarily were completely there. And, I mean, I was thinking about it, and even if you're not familiar with how horror movies are, used to be, or whatever, slashers and so on, I think you can still really like it just because it's this story about these kids that get watched by these creepy watchers that are orchestrating their deaths from miles underground. And so I think it can still be an effective kind of horror scary movie with just a weird twist to it.
So the metaphor for me is pretty clear. We've got these gods who live beneath the earth.
The ancients,
who are essentially film audiences. We have the two guys and everybody in the compound, the secure compound, who are the directors. They are Hollywood. They are the filmmakers. And then we have these people who, the people in the cabin in the woods and the people all over the globe, which is a hilarious bit of horror parody where they go through all of the other types of horror films and different nationalities and things. Those are the people who are... who have to conform, right? There's this moment where you start to realize that these archetypes are not really being lived up to. The virgin who is supposed to die last, it may not really be a virgin. The guy who's supposed to be the best friend, who's supposed to be a jock, well,
he's a sociology
about social
major,
hierarchy
and then he's
like that. Yeah.
On full academic scholarship.
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's really, really funny because it's almost like the horror movie itself within the film is trying to break free of all these stereotypes that audiences demand their horror movies
right.
to be. And the movie that they're trying to create for the ancients has to follow this pattern.
Right.
And there are these artistic flourishes that Richard Jenkins and Bradley Whitford
are
excited
so
about themselves within, you know, these stereotypes that they get excited about. And at the very end, when the head person who turns out to be, I won't even ruin this cameo, turns out to be the most archetypal last woman survivor in horror ever. She comes in and basically says, you know, we work with what we have. You know what I mean? She's like,
yeah.
but I'm not a virgin. We work with what we have. You know what I mean? And then at the end of the movie, when everything goes wrong, the very last comment from the guy is, you know, as the gods are about to break free and destroy the earth is, wow, that would have been a really good scene to see in a movie. So, I mean, everything about this is commenting in one way or another on how lame horror movies are and how rigid I think people expect them to be, you know?
So is it does that make it a perfect commentary, or is it too self-aware?
That's what I was asking earlier. Nobody's answered this.
I said it worked.
Dramatic?
Yeah? I think that self-awareness is what makes it so clever and what made me like it.
Yeah, and that's
and
what
mean,
works.
Look, this is a weird, jump reference. Mm-hmm. No pun intended, but 21 Jump Street was pretty much a giant piece of crap, but it was really funny. And one of the things that I thought was really funny about it was that it just did nothing but make fun of itself the entire time, and it was very aware of what it was. And there was even a joke about nobody having an original idea and people just rehashing old stuff. And I thought, like, that's when that movie had me, and I was like, okay, that's good. And that's kind of the way this was, is it really is. God, there's that whole scene on the motorcycle before he jumps the thing, and like, I was just laughing.
Don't hold
balls
back.
Off. Yeah.
I never do.
Yeah, I never do. You know? So great. It's so great. Yeah.
The Harbinger.
The Harbinger is great. Harbinger's that's incredible. A great cameo.
My favorite scene in the whole bit is when they realize that they're not in an elevator, they're in a cage. And then you get to see all of the other horrible things that could have come out if they had chosen.
Yeah, and the realization.
Yeah,
that
the whiteboard is when they're betting on which creature is going to get summoned, and there's that whiteboard. Like I leaned over I leaned over to Tony and said, "Watch this board. Like there's some hilarious shit on this board."
Yeah.
And this is the second time I got to see it, so I got to look at different parts that I didn't get to see the first time. Some of the options are like Kevin. Like that's one of them. Scorpion. That's another one.
I read today that there's a visual compendium to the, like, you can buy a book that's like this really, really like deep geeking, like pictures of all the monsters. And Kevin is just a normal kid that looks like he works at Blockbuster.
Yeah.
But he disembowels people and dismembers them or whatever.
There's a little, there's a little yellow killbot. Did you guys see that? He's got little buzzsaw arms.
And apparently there's so some funny. Sort of a reference to Firefly. One of the monsters is a reference of, whatever. So should we let the 13-year-old girl talk about the Buffy analogies in there?
I mean, I was just going to say that there was, knowing Joss Whedon's body of work and knowing Goddard's work also. Is it Goddard? Or?
Yeah, it's Drew Goddard.
Knowing both of their work and knowing the metaphoric range that they have.
What is Goddard's work, just so in case people don't know?
Cloverfield. He worked some on Buffy.
Well, he actually is responsible for writing my favorite arc on Buffy season 8, the first comic book season. He also wrote some episodes for, I think, Buffy season 7 and Angel season 5.
Okay.
He did Lost, and he worked on Alias. He did Lost, worked on Alias, and then his three movies, including this one or the other two, are Cloverfield and Let Me In, which are both great, in my opinion.
But I felt if I had come in blind, not knowing much of what either one of them had done, I think I would have been a lot more satisfied with this film, because I think it really would have felt like, oh my gosh, I've never seen anything like this. But knowing their body of work and, you know, their sort of metaphoric range, what they do, I was not surprised by much of what happened. It felt like a revisitation of some of my favorite things about what they do. But in large part, it did feel like a revisitation.
Well, and I'll say that the first two-thirds of the movie are good, but they're not – I mean, they don't, like, shock you. I mean, they're just good. It's when you get to them actually going down in the elevator and getting into the box and you get that reveal, that's when the movie just takes off. The last third of this movie is just – pure enjoyment.
But
pure
let's
fun.
Say that the first two-thirds are essential setup, and that's what makes the last third pay off. The last thing I wanted to say about Whedon, though, since you're on this subject, is that he does something in this movie that he did in most everything else that he's ever done, and it's so fucking rare for people to be able to pull this off. And that is to have this meta thing, to have this comment, to have this parody, to have this ridiculous fictional world, right, that this drama is happening in, and then still, with all those jokes off to the side and all those funny things happening, to create moments of real poignancy. And there's two of them in this movie that I want to point out. The first one is when the blonde girl, who has been, her hair has been dyed blonde to actually physically turn her into a dumb blonde because there's something in the hair dye that makes her stupider. That was hilarious. When she gets killed. And there is a moment there where Bradley Whitford sinks that in. And all this time we've been knowing what's going to happen, and we're kind of laughing, haha, isn't this, you know, funny? But we really see these guys wrestle with this death for a brief moment before he says something about tequila. But and that's really funny. But that moment right there, I felt that. Like, that was a big moment for me. And then the second moment of poignancy that I thought was impressive, in the middle of total chaos, was when the Virgin and the Stoner are in the elevators, in the clear elevators, and they're able to see all these other monsters. And for a brief moment, they're face-to-face with the Hellraiser guy.
Right.
Which, what a shame, how awesome would it have been if they would have actually been able to get Freddy Krueger and Jason and the Hellraiser guy. But there's a moment where she realizes, yes, we're trapped, and yes, this is fucked up, and she looks at this guy, and he feels the same way. That's how I interpreted that.
Yeah.
This guy
yeah.
lives in his stupid little fucking cage, is released once in a blue moon to go out and put his puzzle on the world and have people turn to things and kill people. And for some reason, in that brief moment, it was like it made the world feel real, and that's impressive to be able to pull that off.
Were incredible moments. And I think why is because Goddard showed amazing restraint yeah. in both of those moments. The first moment, it's a shot. It's a single shot on who is the guy from West Wing? Bradley Whitford. And, you know, it's a single shot on him. And that's it.
Wait, not a lot of. Hold on. Are you talking about the scene? Well, maybe it's Eric. Are you talking about the scene where they pray after the first death?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or are you talking about the scene where he says, like, I really root for this girl. She's just got so much heart.
That's much later. That's much later.
That's what I thought. But then you made the tequila reference, and that doesn't happen.
Because it comes just after. But he lets that moment breathe.
But no, the tequila doesn't matter.
It's just a shot. And he lets that moment breathe for just enough time before they jump to the joke. Yeah. And that, I think, shows a lot of restraint that you're not just gunning for that next joke. And the same way, when she is looking at the Hellraiser dude, they hold on her.
Yeah.
They hold on him. They don't need a quippy bit of dialogue. They don't need wooden dialogue. We did get some wooden dialogue at the beginning.
Yeah.
Trevin suggested that it was probably intentional, but if it was, which it probably was because this was an excellent, clever movie.
Yeah, it demands to be seen again, absolutely.
But I still think that if it was intentionally wooden dialogue, then there was a problem with the edit or the tone or yeah. the delivery. Yeah. Because I don't think it totally plays.
Well, and this was a discussion I was having with Eric earlier today. He thought Goddard and Whedon did a good job making you care for these people, and I still think they're basically horror fodder. I don't ever really care for them. I don't want them to die.
Except for Dana, I pretty much agree
yeah.
with you. Yeah.
Man, I think you're rooting for the Stoner kid, too, though. But
yeah.
the
well, yeah, except but he's the guy from Dollhouse, whose name I can't remember, is even though they're all kind of in their early 30s, he looks even older than everybody
yeah,
else to me.
He
looks
like
why is this kid in college?
Well, okay, so your second point, the Hellraiser guy. I remember while I was watching the movie, I remember thinking this guy's a brilliant actor, and it was because she's talking and saying something, and then she starts to freak out about it, and he. I mean, he steps forward, but his eyes,
yeah,
it's
his
like
eyes.
Fucking, it's
he
like
just
Michael Corleone
with his
in the
eyes.
Fucking
yeah.
deli before he pops that dude. You know, he's like the guy's eyes are, you know, darting back and forth, and it's just the most brilliant. Oh, God, yeah. It's gorgeous. It was so great, and I just remember thinking that was a brilliant, brilliant moment.
Yeah. One last thing I want to say. Obviously, we all like this film to varying degrees, but big rock fist up from all of us probably, is the payoff, right? So we have this big setup. Everything's carefully constructed. Like your short film, we're given certain things at certain times strategically so that we can start piecing this puzzle together. Mm-hmm. There is no twist ending. But what instead you get is one of those payoffs that just seems like something you've been dreaming about all your life as a kid. It's like comic book fans are so excited to see the Avengers fight together when these monsters are all released in the hallway to feast
so good.
on the corporate office drones. It's just glorious and the CGI is good. It's not great, but I just wanted to say that script wise to be so careful leading up to that moment, and then have a moment that big, you rarely see that in horror movies, if ever.
And that does pay off very well.
Yeah,
and I'll defend the CGI with the sheer number of creatures that they use on the screen. They look pretty good.
Yeah.
So the,
and
the,
for the movie's
the end,
budget.
The
like,
end
to
end? Like the very end? Okay, so we have our cameo.
Yeah.
We have our cameo. And see, this is like this is where like my I was telling Trey that I'm a really shitty critic because I might like if I manage my expectations, I can be entertained by the most banal shit. Like, she should have walked up with a gun and shot the guy in the face and not said a, like she should have fucking Raiders of the Lost Ark that shit. And there should have been a moment where she walks up, you see who she is, and you know they look at each other, and then she just goes poo, and she fucking shoots the dude, and that, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
That should have happened.
But you realize that what we were seeing there, again, was another horror trope, right?
Yeah.
Because well, at the end of any horror movie, they have
discussion.
To explain
everything
I know,
that
I
happened.
I know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm just, you know, it's just one of those things where it's like...
What I wanted to happen, yeah. And I told Tony and Trey this, I would have loved it if she comes up and starts to explain everything that we've already seen and mm-hmm. that the movie's done a really good subtle job of explaining along the way. But she gets ready to say, like, you've all got a larger part, and then something just comes out and just kills her real fast.
Right.
Like,
see,
if
now,
she got ready to give a speech, and then a werewolf just tears her in
if
half.
That had happened, if that had happened, the yeah. answer to your original question would have been, yes, it's too self-aware, and it
yeah.
ruined it.
Yeah.
So fuck you.
No.
But just really quickly, there are a couple of things that I just think deserve high praise. The whole scene with the Japanese girls turning the spirit into a frog.
So funny.
So brilliant.
So
that
funny.
Was so brilliant. And, I mean, there are a handful of references that get... I mean, for American audiences,
yeah.
like an American audience that doesn't know anything about like you know foreign films or foreign horror tropes yeah. or anything like that, they're going to look at that and be like, "What in
did
the
you,
hell?"
Did
just
you see
happened?
The two little girls from The Shining?
No,
I saw them. Yep, they were in there
nice.
In the box.
Yep, they were in one of the boxes. The two little girls from
The
Shining.
Awesome.
Yep.
But I mean, the other thing is I think the ending is actually really sort of Japanese. Horror anime horror ending
yeah.
It's pretty great, and it's also something that I think a lot of American audiences kind of crave. It's
yeah.
just like why doesn't it just all blow up and go to hell?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know? It's like,
well, the great thing is that we have again, we go back to that real thing, as silly as it be, as it might be, for the architect to come out and explain everything and not just end it the way it should go. We have all these moments where the two characters have to make decisions about
yeah.
how much their lives are worth. And I think that survival instinct that most horror movies prey on, right, to exist, you actually see that happen at the end of this movie, and you believe it. This kid is like, I don't fucking care. I'm not going to let you kill me.
Okay, so the very end, when neither one of them will sacrifice themselves
yeah.
to save the rest of the
yeah.
world, so does that fit into your metaphor in terms of the narcissism of American youth culture?
Oh.
Boom.
Maybe, but these are the
yeah.
characters. Yeah. Yeah. Just throw it down.
Peace out. Tony Lattish. That was good.
Yeah, I mean, but these are characters who are there to entertain the
right.
people watching.
Well, so
sure.
My
sure.
point is why in your estimation, because I did really think to myself like why are they so fucking selfish that this is clearly real?
Right.
Why the fuck wouldn't you just off yourself and, like, you know, do that one random act of kindness for the fucking rest of the world?
Yeah.
Sure, but, I mean, not to argue plot more than 5 seconds, but the virgin can't kill herself first. Has to be the dope kid. Otherwise,
yeah.
it doesn't count.
Right.
And you've killed the two heroes, the two characters who would make that choice. You've already killed them.
Well, and if she kills him, she's instantaneously kind of unlikable somehow. But
which she was for a brief moment.
She
that
was.
That was pretty cool. That they
but I wanted
that as
her.
Well.
I wanted her to cap him.
Yeah.
I did. You know, but like, but
he had that moment though, where he's like, "After all I've done, I can't believe."
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And yeah, like, really,
yeah,
really,
because that's another horror movie trope,
right?
The person is supposed to do the right thing and save humanity at the end. But the nice thing about this movie is he is he's the guy who sits in the back of the movie theater at every horror movie and says and calls bullshit on it. He's like, "No, that's not is that really a good idea? We're all going to go into separate rooms."
And
like,
yeah, that's one of the best.
Wait, why is he acting like a dumb jock? fuck? He's getting better grades than I do. Like, why is she acting like a vamp? Yeah. She's
going to the cellar. Yeah. Did you guys fucking hear that? I swear I heard that. Yeah. Did you guys hear that?
He's the only one. Yeah.
And I love the fact that he's kind of got that nihilist, like, fuck him.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
like,
it's foreshadowed.
Like, you know what? Humanity, fuck it.
Well, yep. It's not even at the end. He says that in the first.
Yeah.
He says that in the first 5 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
Like when they're on in the Rambler, and he's like, "The whole world's going to hell. We just don't know it yet. Society's filling in the cracks, and really, we just need to all."
Oh, I can't wait. Forgot about that movie again.
Yeah. Well, let's go tonight. So, like, let's go right now.
Because I forgot about that the first time, and I caught it yesterday when we watched it. I was like, "Oh wow, the writing was on the wall from that." Like in the first 10 minutes of the movie. But
might I also mention that Whedon and Goddard wrote this over a weekend.
Yeah.
Really?
High as fuck.
I
don't know.
Read that.
How else do you come up with every monster movie of all? Like, you got to be high as a motherfucker to go, dude, we're going to just put them all in it. Like, all of them.
Now, was anybody else disappointed by the merman at the end?
I thought that was hilarious.
I just thought that was one callback too many. Because he mentions it, what, 3 times in the movie?
Yeah,
and they actually give it to you.
We knew it was coming.
I know. But, I mean, a nice little shock would have been if they didn't give it to you.
No, dude, but God. I was just disappointed so in funny. What it was. I wanted him to fucking get speared with a Triton.
I was... The bit... Honestly, I loved all the Jenkins Whitford stuff, all their dialogue and banter, and then when they're taking bets.
They're like the two old dudes in the fucking Muppet movie.
Yeah.
Like
Waldorf, like, and Statler.
You know, and as a fan of Angel, I could have done with a little more Amy Acker, but that's just me.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, I was happy that she was in the background because I think she is difficult to watch.
I don't know. I was utterly amused by everything in the movie, and the scenes that Whitford and Jenkins have are just so funny. All the scenes building up to the choice.
The entire bet sequence is just great.
The bets and it's awesome. It's just so funny and on point.
Okay, so
I will say that's all the to that point when the cellar door slams open.
Yeah.
It's so great because I think it is the stoner kid who somebody goes, the wind blew it open. And the stoner kid goes, what kind of fucking sense does that make?
Yeah. In what world does that make sense? Blew it open.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
What world does that make sense?
Okay. So just to wrap up, obviously we all like the film. I'm going to give Tony a recap of our rating system.
Okay.
Here at Scenes Dealers.
You need to provide examples, like a movie example for each.
A movie example for each one?
Yeah.
Okay, Rock Fist Way Down would be Soul Plane. Okay.
War Horse.
Or Hide and Seek.
Can I vote
lockout
on like the Hustler scale, the fully erect?
That's basically what this
is. Okay,
yeah. We're giving you two options up, one in the middle, and three options up, one in the middle, and two down. So we have a 6 scale. So it's Rock Fist Way Up, which is perfect fucking Godfather shit. Yep. We have
Drive.
solid Rock Fist Up. Which would be Drive.
No. Rock Fist Way Up. I mean, come on. Art last year.
And then we have Minor Rock Fist Up, which is like, what did I just see the other day that wasn't horrible, but wasn't that good either?
Three Stooges.
Yeah, the Three Stooges. Yeah, I gave it a Minor Rock Fist Up.
Yeah.
The Swiss Fist, Complete Neutrality. Okay, it's kind of a cop-out.
Yeah, it's
minor,
basically
Minor Down yourself. And then Way Down.
Yeah. Did you review Two Sisters, and did we get fisted?
I have not written a review yet, but I would give that a very solid Rock Fist Up.
Fucking A. Yeah. All right. Thanks, dude. You're just saying that because I'm in the room, aren't you?
As soon as edit that out.
Yeah, I'll cut it.
All right, we'll start
put
with Trey.
Point in.
I give it a Minor Rock Fist Up. I think I was a little too familiar to give it Way Up, so it wasn't mind-blowing to me. They're doing a lot of the same things. They're doing it well, and I think the Whedonites will be thoroughly pleased. I think they'll be thoroughly pleased, and I do think that for somebody who doesn't know much about it, they're going to be really kind of shocked and amazed. I think they're going to have a lot of fun.
I never watched Buffy or Angel. I did watch Firefly, so I'm going one click down from the top with the solid Rock Fist, because it's not the Godfather.
And that's where I'd go too. I think on the strength of its final act, it would be a solid.
And yeah, solid for me too. I loved it. Loved everything about it.
So why not Way Up? because it's not The Godfather. It's not true.
Drive or The Godfather.
Right. I had There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men as my only two way ups that year. So I'm giving it a solid rock fist up, too. And I think that maybe this rating system and all rating systems are something that we'll probably address later on another podcast. But this whole idea of can a movie escape its genre or be better than its genre? Or transcend its genre, or are horror movies always going to be, relegated to being a tick under everything else because of what they are?
Did and you we'll just do that at a later time. On next week's episode?
Yeah, we're gonna end it. I'm not gonna let us go any further into that because that's next week. So.
All right, goodbye,
Van Hammer. Right now.
Thanks for having me. Seriously, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Tony, thank you. Thanks for coming.
And I didn't mean to say fuck off or fuck you or whatever. We're like new besties. I was playing it up for the cameras.
Yeah. All right.
That's what all his new besties say to him.
That's true. We have most people get friendship bracelets. We get fuck you bracelets. Yeah. That's how it is here. Anyway, go to the evening of 8-Bit tonight. We'll see you there. And other than that, have a good weekend.